Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:34 on the afternoon of Monday, March 15th, 2010. We have a full committee here today. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Egan, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We've got three bills on the agenda today: SB 244, Governor's Duty Station; SB 284, Campaign Expenditures; and SB 153, Mobile Homes as Real Property. And let's begin with SB 244, Governor's Duty Station. I see a representative from the prime sponsor's office is here. We also have a prime sponsor, Senator Egan is number two, I'm number three, and Senator Thomas is also on the bill. But do we have someone from Senator Stedman's office to present the bill? We do. Darwin Peterson, welcome. Nice to see you. Put yourself on the record and tell us about SB 244.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. This is the second hearing on the bill. If you would like me to run through the introduction as I did last time, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, just to get ourselves reoriented. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 244 just codifies in statute the administrative requirement that Juneau is officially the governor's duty station. Currently in statute, there are no provisions that require the governor to reside in the capital city and occupy the governor's mansion during his or her term. So it was the intent of the sponsor to simply codify that requirement in statute, as many other states have done, so that it's very clear the legislature is setting the policy that the governor's duty station is Juneau.
Excellent. Questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor? You have in your packets a memo from Jack Chenoweth, which was in response to a question raised at the last hearing about whether, if we pass this bill, a future governor might be charged with an ethics complaint for living away from the Capitol. And as I read Mr. Chenoweth's analysis, the short answer is no. If you look at this page 2, first full paragraph, he writes, the measure does not propose an amendment to the Executive Branch Ethics Act. While an ethics charge certainly may be initiated against a governor who spends inordinate time away from the duty station designated in the measure, if that assertion is the whole argument offered in support of the claim or complaint, then in my judgment it would be a complaint without merit. So I think Mr. Chenoweth sort of notes that anybody can bring an ethics complaint, but the issue is would it be valid? And the answer is no. So I think that was the main concern the committee had during the last hearing. Are there other questions or comments from members of the committee? I think we took public testimony at the last hearing and we've closed public testimony. That brings the bill before us for discussion and a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to Senate Bill 244, I would move that the committee move this bill out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill will be moved out of committee. We'll take a short at ease.
Thank you, Mr.
We are back on the record. We'll take up now SB 153. Sorry. There we go. mobile homes is real property. The bill is brought to you by yours truly, and it was a bill that I filed last year and has begun to, it's had a hearing in the State Affairs Committee. This is the second and last committee referral, so we will hear it and hold it today. It's a fairly lengthy bill. It's 21 pages, but it's actually very, very simple in its intent and purpose. The idea is to allow homeowners who have mobile homes on real property, not so much mobile homes in trailer parks, but mobile homes on their on land they own, give them the ability to convert those homes into real property. Right now, the title to mobile homes is dealt with through the Division of Motor Vehicles, and that makes conventional financing impossible to get for mobile home owners. And so the idea is that this change will give the owners of manufactured homes better access to traditional mortgage financing, which of course offers lower interest rates, and it helps them increase the value of their homes by so doing. It also helps prevent clouded titles that offer hinder clean transactions involving manufactured homes, and that's the idea. We have excellent help in this bill, mainly through Wells Fargo. We've got Patrick Green and Brenda Murnick online, as well as Carl Springer from DMV. Carl is here to testify. Brenda Murnick is here to testify. We also have George Carnahan here to testify. But maybe we could have my staff come forward and just have someone here representing the office at the witness table to answer questions from the committee about the bill. Welcome and put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman French. My name is Kate Herring. I am a staff to Senator French.
Questions for either the bill sponsor or staff about the bill? Senator Coghill.
Thank you. I haven't had a chance to read all the way through this, but the mechanism for, it looks like combining the motorhome title that is with DMV and a title guarantee that has it tied with the property, as I understand. Could you explain that mechanism?
I think George Ginsburg should be online to go over the technical aspects of the bill that talk about that change in particular. So he might be better equipped to answer those questions.
I would concur. Other easier questions for the bill sponsor or members of the staff? Maybe we could turn to Mr. Ginsburg. Mr. Ginsburg, are you on the line?
Yes, Senator, I am.
And did you hear the question from Senator Coghill?
I did.
Could you answer it, please, after you put your name on the record?
Okay, my name is George Ginsburg. I am with the firm of McGlinchey Stafford, and we are outside counsel to Wells Fargo. Senator, if I may, can I give you a little background and then answer the question?
I think that would be helpful.
Okay. A manufactured home, like a car, is documented in terms of ownership by a certificate of title, and the ownership is transferred by certificate of title, again like a car. And also like a car, financing of the manufactured home is secured by a lien which is noted physically on the certificate of title. But unlike a car, a manufactured home can be permanently affixed to real property, and problems begin in Alaska when it is. Currently, the law in Alaska is that the only way for a lender to perfect a security interest in a manufactured home that's been affixed to real property is both to note the lien on the certificate of title and to file a fixture filing under the Alaska Uniform Commercial Code. The problem, though, is that the Alaska Department of Motor Vehicles will not issue a certificate of title to a manufactured home that's been permanently affixed to real estate because it claims it's no longer a vehicle. And as a result, you have situations in which various localities around the state have been doing their own thing and their own informal procedures, but the bottom line is that a homeowner who has a manufactured home that's now permanently affixed to real estate is really in no man's land. She cannot sell the manufactured home because there's no way to document the change of ownership. She can't finance the manufactured home either, because there's no way that a lender can safely lend against it, because there's no way to perfect the security interest in the public record. What this bill is designed to do is to establish a procedure, which I will call a conversion procedure, which, by the way, most states have. Alaska is one of the relatively few states that do not, by which, once the procedure is completed, a manufactured home would be considered real estate for all legal purposes. Now, this would not involve a combination of an existing certificate of title and some kind of title guarantee. What it would involve is a surrender, a cancellation of the certificate of title, and instead a recording on the real estate records of what's called an affidavit of affixation, which is a prescribed form which has to set forth a variety of information. And after the affidavit is recorded in the land records, a copy of it would be sent back to the Division of Motor Vehicles, and the certificate of title, if there is one, would be canceled. If there isn't a certificate of title, because it's a brand new manufactured home, for example, and all we have is a manufacturer's statement of origin, that would be canceled according to the procedure I just described. And if neither one of them exists, because either a certificate of title was never issued and the statement of origin can't be found, or the certificate of title can't be found, then instead you would have, what the homeowner would do is would file what we call in the bill a confirmation of conversion. But essentially it works the same way. The confirmation of conversion would go hand in hand with the affidavit of affixation, and at the end of the day, what you would have is a record in the real estate office that the manufactured home has been affixed to real estate permanently, and what you would have is a record in the Division of Motor Vehicles to the same effect, either canceling the certificate of title or the statement of origin, or confirming that the manufactured home has been converted to real estate. After that happens, then the manufactured home is part of the real estate, the same as a stick-built house. It's sold by a deed, just as any other house would be, and it's financed by a mortgage, which also, as I understand it, but I will let others comment on this who know more than I do, but aside from the fact that now the homeowner is out of this no man's land that I mentioned, the homeowner would be able, at less expensive rates, to finance the home, because this would be considered a true classic real estate loan, subject to purchase if it otherwise conforms by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and at lower rates than the financing of a manufactured home that's considered personal property. Likewise, the bill also has a procedure to be followed in the event that a home which had previously been permanently affixed to real estate is now physically detached from the land. What would happen in that case is that the homeowner, who also has to own the land in this case or occupy the land by a lease for at least 20 years, as is the case with conversion, would file not an affidavit of affixation, but what's called an affidavit of severance. What would happen again is that there would be something in the real estate records, publicly available, to show that the home had been severed. The homeowner would then apply for a title to the from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And from that point on, it would be treated as personal property, just as it had been before the conversion. The bill has a feature to allow somebody whose home had already been converted to real property prior to the time the act takes effect to avail herself of this, to get her out of this fix. And essentially, that's the mechanism. It's somewhat of a lengthy bill. I know that was mentioned in the opening remarks, but it's a lengthy bill, candidly, for two reasons more than anything else. Number one, as you can imagine from my description of it, the details are reasonably complicated, and we wanted to get it right. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't any room for erroneous interpretations. And at the same time, there were other sections that have nothing to do with this that were amended because we wanted to make sure that certain definitions were consistent. Certain statutes, for example, define manufactured home. We wanted to make sure that, to the extent relevant, they were all defined the same way to avoid any possibility that somehow one may be considered something for this purpose but not for that if they're all related, and so on. So I hope I've answered your question, but if I haven't, go ahead.
Follow-up, Senator Cockhill.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe the thing that got a little confusing to me was the part that you had to have it affixed to land to make it part of that real property, and then there was an exception to it. And
that's right.
And I just heard what that exception was, so that helped me understand. I knew it had to be tied to land until something, and he described that what that was. So, yeah, I think I'm okay. I understand better now.
Thank you. And we have a question from Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ginsburg, this wouldn't have any effect on what they call modular homes, would it?
No.
And sometimes called manufactured homes.
Well, manufactured home, first of all, we define it by referring to the definition or copying the definition currently in the Alaska Uniform Commercial Code. No, this is a home that's built physically at the factory and either put on blocks or put on a permanent foundation. But this is not a modular home. This is not something that's brought to the premises, prefabricated, and assembled on site.
Okay, thank you.
This would affect only manufactured homes as I described it, not modulars.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any downside to doing this? In other words, would this cause property taxes for people who own these pieces of property? Classifying them from personal property to real property, would that cause property taxes to increase, for example?
Well, I can't speak to the tax structure, sir, but it would, I'm sure, affect the real property tax because it's going to be considered real property. And in fact, in many states, one of the tests the courts use to determine whether something is real property is whether it's subject to the real property tax. So, again, I suspect the answer will be yes, but I don't know that that's necessarily a downside. The fact is we're talking about a homeowner who has permanently affixed her home to real estate with the object that they're one and the same. So if anything, it may be a benefit to the state in terms of increased tax revenues, but frankly, I'm not looking to sell the bill on that basis. I don't think we're talking about very much in terms of money, but I imagine, yes, it would increase the value of the real estate and therefore presumably the real property tax a person would pay.
Follow up? Senator Wilikowski.
And I guess as probably the legislator with probably the most number of mobile homes in his district or one of the most, I can tell you that if this is going to increase the property taxes of my many, many people in my district, then I would have some big concerns with that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm going to let others answer, Senator, how many we're talking about. Frankly, I don't think it's that many. But remember, at the moment, we're talking about people who, while they may not pay real estate taxes on the manufactured home, can't sell it and can't finance it. And all I can say is that so far, we have run into no opposition from consumer groups, taxpayer groups, not only in Alaska, but again, I'll let the Wells Fargo people speak to this, but to my knowledge at least, in basically any state, because it's to their advantage to do this. Otherwise, they're stuck basically with a white elephant that they can't do anything with.
Mr. Ginsburg, let me jump in, and just from a previous hearing, I can inform Senator Wilkowski and other members of the committee, this will not apply to the many, many mobile homes, trailer homes that we find in Anchorage that are sitting on in what I call a trailer park, where you're renting space from a landlord. This does not apply to that situation. This applies to someone who's put a mobile home on a piece of property he or she owns and now wants to affix it to a permanent foundation there. The only exception is for, I think, a piece of property you have a 20-year lease on. If you've got a 20-year lease, then that's long enough to qualify you for the conversion process to real property. So for folks who are living in trailer parks, this is not an option because the vast majority of those, you have a landlord who owns the space, you pay space rent every month to that landlord, and those trailer houses would not be affected. Mr. Ginsburg, is that your understanding?
That is exactly right, Senator.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Ginsburg while we have him on the line? Ms. Herring.
Sorry. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this is also a voluntary process. They do not have to do this.
Right.
It's something, if they want to increase the value of their real property, they go through this process, but it is not, we're not holding anybody's feet to the flames.
The state can't do it to you. No. You go to the state.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
We do have a couple of folks that line up to testify. Mr. Ginsburg, if you could stand by, let's turn to Carl Springer from the Department of Motor Vehicles. Mr. Springer, are you on the line?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you.
If you go ahead and identify yourself, and then we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
My name is Carl Springer. I'm the Motor Vehicle Registrar for the State Division of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you.
The Division of Motor Vehicles is not opposed to SB 153. However, we have some concerns about the requirements of DMV. DMV's expertise is in the area of driver's licensing and titling motor vehicles and registering motor vehicles. We do not have any experience or expertise in real property law. Currently, DMV is required to title a manufactured mobile home at the owner's request. However, the owner is not required to title a manufactured mobile home. There are currently 8,291 manufactured mobile homes titled in the state of Alaska. I would venture to guess that a healthy percentage of these have been removed from the wills and placed on a semi-permanent foundation and skirted, thereby possibly qualifying the manufactured mobile home as real property. I have no idea how many of these are located in trailer parks, but I would imagine a good percentage of them are. SB 153 would have DMV duplicating the efforts of the Recorder's Office and Real Estate Title Insurance Agency. DMV currently records the primary lien or encumbrance as disclosed by the owner, and HB 153 would have DMV responsible for determining the existence or non-existence of other liens or encumbrances, essentially performing real property title search. The attachment and severance requirements of SB 153 are of little consequence if an owner can execute these affidavits, even if they only intend to permanently affix or sever a manufactured mobile home from real property, rather than actually doing it when the event occurs. For these reasons, we feel SB 153 needs some additional clarification, and we would be happy to work with the sponsor to address those concerns.
Mr. Springer, thank you for that, and we stand by ready to work through any amendments you may have or suggestions we'd be happy to address through the committee process or in communications with my office. So please let us know with as much specificity as you can which sections you seek to amend.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We also have online Brenda Miernick from Wells Fargo. Are you there?
I am.
Welcome to the committee. Please put your name on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
I'm Brenda Miernick, Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. I am a branch manager for Wells Fargo Home Mortgage, and on behalf of Wells Fargo, I appreciate the opportunity to submit testimony in support of Alaska Senate Bill 153. Senate Bill 153 will amend state law in Alaska to provide a formal method of eliminating the certificate of title to a manufactured home and converting the home to real property when the home is or will be permanently affixed to real property. as well as obtaining a new certificate of title when a home previously affixed to real property is later physically severed from it. Alaska's current statutes do not meet the eligibility requirements to sell a mortgage loan for a manufactured home to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, including the process to legally classify the home as real property and placing the lender in first lien position. Wells Fargo has had to turn away business to potential borrowers because Alaska does not have a clear method of converting a factory-built home to real property, especially older manufactured homes that come back on the market for resale. Senate Bill 153 would bring state definitions of manufactured homes into accordance with HUD definitions to create a system for title transfer and property conversion. Additionally, it would create a means for titling manufactured homes that have been affixed to property, but the title cannot be found. We feel this bill will, one, help manufactured homeowners who have had their manufactured home already affixed to real property be better able to gain access to credit and be able to more easily sell their homes. Two, help manufactured homeowners in the state increase the value of their homes by allowing them to convert their manufactured homes to real property, including manufactured homes not covered by certificates of title or for which the certificates of title cannot be found. Three, help lenders gain perfected security interest in manufactured homes. Four, help the Alaska Division of Motor Vehicles by putting in place a formalized procedure for canceling a title when a manufactured home is put on a permanent foundation. And five, increase property tax revenue in the municipalities in Alaska that levy property taxes as a result of manufactured homes being converted to and considered real property. Are there any questions?
Ms. Myernick, let me see. Don't see any hands raised. Thanks so much for being available today.
Oh, no problem.
We also have George Carnahan at the Kenai LIO. Mr. Carnahan, are you on the line?
Hey, George Carnahan. I live in a similar property under your Alaska statute 2945.070. I don't have any electricity, and come July, I'll be 6 years that I've been green. I have solar power. I harvest rain and snow and ice for human consumption, fire protection, irrigation, and sanitation. I am not attached to the ground. And this, the law that you've had on the books for a number of years, it dictates if you have any one of the three elements attached to the ground, hooked up to utilities, gas or electric, or sewer facilities, you're classified as real estate property. I don't know why you guys want to be a union for the corporations and just toss this existing law out the window, because all you're doing is increasing taxes, and the whole economy, lower 48 and Alaska, getting the same way. We just pay too many taxes. If you want a magnet in the Kenai Peninsula, all you got to do is eliminate the taxes, and you keep people from going to Anchorage where it's tax-free zone. Is there any questions about being attached to the ground, connected to utilities, gas or electric, or sewer facilities? I don't see why there's a need to delete on page 13, line 2 through 8, delete that stuff out of the existing code.
What page?
Page 13.
Mr. Carnahan, thank you for your testimony. Anything else you want to add, sir?
No, I just, I vote for people that represent the people, not the corporations. Thank you. Have a good day.
You're very welcome. Thanks for making time to testify to the committee this afternoon.
Yes, sir.
Is there anyone else here in the room that wants to testify on SB 153? Anybody else online who wants to testify? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And we will hold the bill over. I know it is a lengthy bill, and I want the members to have plenty of time to read through it. Any questions that come up, we've got a list of folks who can answer those questions for you through your offices, and we'll bring it back after folks have had time to make sure that they're up on the provisions. So with that, we will set this one aside and put the short at ease while we get ready for the next bill.
You don't want to.
Let's go back on the record. It's just a little bit after 2 o'clock, and we are here to work on SB, what is it, 184? 284. Numbers get higher. We have a CS brought to us through the hard work of Alpheus Billard, who took the amendments that we inserted last Friday, produced a CS. It is /R. If I could get a motion to adopt that.
So moved.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. It's been moved that we take up 284 Judiciary /R as the working document. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. Before we get, Senator Coghill has brought us a couple of amendments. Before we get to that, we have a memo from Mr. Bullard, who prepared this CS, addressing one issue that I think is pretty straightforward and needs fixing, and that is, you'll see that point number one in his memo points out that we have a redundant provision that slipped into the bill on page 6, lines 5, 6, and 7, you'll see is redundant with what's on the next page on lines 28, 29, and 30. That's the upshot of paragraph 1 of his memo. And so it would be my suggestion that amendment number 1 today to this CS to be to delete lines 5, 6, and 7 on page 6. That's the suggestion of his memo in paragraph number 1. So that's the motion to amend the CS by removing lines 5, 6, and 7 on page 6. Is there any objection to the motion?
I just object for discussion purposes.
Very good. Senator Wilkowski.
No, I'm just trying to
Take a minute to
just looking at what he's recommending and what you're doing, and just want to make sure we're tracking.
Right. What's happened is that we have in both places a requirement that the communication, that there be something in the communication that says to this effect that it's not authorized or approved by any candidate. That's what lines 5, 6, and 7 on page 6 say. That's what lines 28, 29, and 30 say on page 7. And as Mr. Bullard points out, that's just, you may wish to consider an amendment to remove the redundant requirement of the bill's A2E.
Okay, I would remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, that amendment number 1 is carried.
Got it.
Mr. Bullard also points out that there is a, in paragraph 2, Mr. Bullard points out the crime of campaign misconduct in the second degree is defined by AS 1556014, and is it looks as if Senator Coghill has brought us an amendment to deal with that. Senator Coghill, is that right?
Yes, that would be the R2 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't we go ahead and call that amendment number 2, R2, and I'll move it, and I'll object to it, and you can walk us through it.
Mr. Chairman, this is, actually, I probably could have Mr. Bullard walk through it, because it was based on what I read from his legal analysis, which says that under the crime of misconduct in the second degree, under this section A of 1556040A, didn't have the it had the group candidate or individual in there, but needed to have person in there, as we have been defining it in this particular. And I could probably have him enlighten me as much as you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Boyle, are you on the line?
Senator French, Senator Coghill, members of the committee, I am on the line.
Thank you. If you go ahead and just identify yourself for the record and give us a couple of lines on this amendment.
My name is Alpheus Bullard. I'm an attorney with Ledge Legal. And the purpose of this amendment is right now
at Section 15 of the bill, if you look on page 7, line 20, you'll see in subsection B that individual group or non-group entity has been replaced with person to correspond with the Supreme Court's holding in Citizens United to capture that universe of people who are now allowed to make communications. The change suggested in amending campaign conduct is to replace that candidate, group, or individual in a similar fashion as we have here in Section 15, subsection B of the bill.
And it looks like we're just making the one word change there on line 15 of amendment number 2 from candidate, group, or individual to person.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Senator Coghill.
Mr. Bullard, it's a conforming amendment that conforms Section 15 of our bill with the statute 1556, 14A. Is that the way I understand it?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, that is correct.
And Mr. Bullard, while we have you on the line, if you could remind us what the severity of the crime of campaign misconduct in the second degree, is that a B misdemeanor?
Senator French, if you'd hold on just a moment, I'll be able to answer that in a moment. I don't have my statutes here.
We will hold on.
Senator French, it is a Class B misdemeanor.
90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. I think that's right. We will double check. With the change of those three words, candidate, group, or individual to person, encompassing the corporations and unions that may be making independent expenditures, I'll remove my objection to amendment number 2. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, then amendment number 2 carries. And thank you, Senator Coghill. That brings us to amendment number 3, which is backslash R.1, also brought by Senator Coghill. I will move amendment number 3 and object to it, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's three things that I think should be done because of this amendment. One of them was already done, and that was striking Section E on page 6, line 5 through 7. And that was taken out, that section that was redundant, according to Mr. Bullard. And then the other...
Senator Coghill, just show me where in your amendment we've done that.
On the first line, page 5, line 18 through 6, line 7, it just deleted that whole section and then rewrote it. And so it would have deleted that Section E.
I see.
But the other thing is, probably the part that you're not going to agree with me the most on, is I went to the three largest contributors, which had been line 14. And that's an argument that I'd love to have with you, Mr. Chairman. However, what the purpose of the amendment was to try to codify the same issue. So if you look on your bill on page 5 and line 22, it says candidates and groups may identify the name of the campaign chairperson. And then on line 24, it says a person other than a candidate and an individual or a political party shall clearly identify, et cetera. And my attitude was they should both be required to. And so this amendment says that all communication shall be, if you look on line 4 of my amendment, shall clearly identify by the words paid for. And then it kind of rewrites a section for that clarity. So the three things that changes was requiring it under all circumstances, and then deleted that Section E, and then challenged the from the five largest contributors to adding three. My concern was that as I stated last time, I don't have any problem with full disclosure, but I do have a problem with that's the only thing people will ever be able to hear during a campaign spiel. And my thought was to try to take that section out totally, but weighing the votes on this committee, I thought at least we should try to slim it down to what I would consider a reasonable time frame, because they are going to have to still report all of these campaign finance contributions in the aggregate of over $100 in their campaign finance disclosure anyway. So this requirement, to me, is number one, onerous, but at least with three, time-consuming-wise, I think probably more appropriate. So those are the three things I'm trying to do in the bill, Mr. Chairman.
And just so I'm clear, you have on lines 17, 18, and 19 a requirement that the candidate, I take it in a normal, what I would call a normal campaign advertisement, state the name, you know, I am Joe Smith, and I approve this message. Is that what you're after?
True. And if you look in the bill, the CS that we're working off of, from page 5, line 18 through 22, basically says that. Let's see.
Well, it says it's going to be paid for by the address of the candidate. Let's just stick with candidate, Joe Smith. All communications shall be clearly identified by the words paid for by following the name or address of the person, Joe Smith, paying for the communication. In addition, the candidate may identify the name of their campaign chairperson. And your amendment would eliminate that requirement, although I guess you could ask really what that brings to the party, identifying the campaign chairperson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at the beginning of my amendment, it does say identified by the words paid for by and then approved by the that candidate. This is true.
Mm. If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire.
I think what Senator Coghill's amendment is attempting to replace is on page 6, subsection E, that's saying that the communication, if not made to influence, is not authorized or approved, but rather you're putting it in the affirmative. And I guess I would just argue that I think that's where you are going to run into a problem with the test on it being unduly burdensome and possibly an interference. I mean, the ruling by the court is emphasizing that that a corporation is a person and that they have a First Amendment right to speak. And I think that putting this extra step in there that says that the candidate has to say that they approve the corporation's right to speak, I would think would go outside the bounds. So that's the concern I have. I'd love to hear Mr. Bullard's opinion about it.
And just to make sure we're clear about what we're describing in sort of almost a point of order, I think, and Senator Coghill, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you are lines 9 through 16 describe the disclosure requirements of, let's just call them, a corporation for a person other than an individual or a candidate. You're going to, you know, who's the corporation's principal officer, a statement from the principal officer approving the communication, and the name and city and state of residence of the three largest contributors. That's all for corporations, unions, groups, and so forth.
That would be my, and then the candidate,
the candidate bringing it forth of their own would have to have an approving statement. Okay.
Still having the words paid for by.
Got it.
And just so I'm clear, Senator Coghill, the bill as it stands requires that those disclosures be audible in, you know, radio ad or a TV ad. Do you envision lines 9 through 16, do you envision that being text on a screen or being audible?
Mr. Chairman, I think different section of statute, it seemed to me like it would require them to be audible for radio, and but I could stand to be corrected on that.
Actually, I think you're right. Section 12, I think, of the bill as it stands, modifies A to C, which jibes with your amendment. But that it says the requirements of A to C must be read in a manner easily heard. Okay, so that's taken care of by another section. You're correct. And then just I want to walk through what page 6, lines 19 to 20 are deleted. And I'm not sure what that's keyed off of. Oh, no, wait, yeah.
Six.
I'm just looking at the bottom of your amendment, line 23 says, page 6, lines 19, 20. It says, insert A1 and A2C. A1, A2C. So I think that's jibes. And then on page 29 of line 6, you just basically renumber things accordingly. And I see this was drafted by Mr. Bullard to this CS. I'm going to take it. Mr. Bullard.
Senator French.
Comments on amendment number 3, the backslash R.1.
If there are members of the committee, if there are specific questions about this amendment, I'd be happy to answer those. I have no comments.
Okay. You've heard the discussion. I think, as I understand it, the change this makes to the underlying CS is that it reduces from 5 to 3 the largest contributors and uses a 12-month sort of a test for that, determining who the largest contributors are, and adds a requirement that the candidate has approved his or her own campaign advertisements. Is that right?
Got it.
Senator French, members of the committee, it shifts it a little bit as well. The way that disclosure is provided, we have here in the amendment that business that may be provided. The campaign chairperson has dropped out, and then all persons under line 1 are required to provide that information. In the bill, it was only a person other than a candidate, individual, or political party was required to do that. And then it tracks in a similar fashion, but not exactly, all the requirements of the bill except 5 contributors are narrowed to 3. The 12-month period is true of both the amendment and the bill. And then a candidate is required to name themselves and provide a statement approving the communication. That is new.
Thank you, Mr. Bullard. I guess I'm just, thinking aloud about this. I don't know that I agree about the candidate part. It just seems to me that 9/10 of the campaign ads I see are from the candidate. I don't see how you could otherwise confuse the fact that this is a candidate, this is a statement from the candidate approving the communication. That's a federal rule. And I like 5 better than 3, although I do like the idea that everybody provides the person's address or person's principal place of business. So I guess if I were doing this, I'd pluck a little bit of this out, but not much else. Other thoughts from members of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with your sentiments. Parts of this I like, parts of this I would like to tweak, perhaps. I do disagree with reducing from 5 to 3. We had this discussion last week, and I think in the environment that we're in, where we have corporations and other organizations, unions, able to make unlimited campaign contributions, I think we should lean on the side of more disclosure rather than less. So I would have some concerns with that. But on the other hand, I agree with you that identifying the other principal place of business, I think it's a good thing. Kind of could go either way on the candidate approving the communication, but I guess I would support this with some modifications. But as it's written, I probably would not be inclined to do so.
Why don't we do this? I have been eager to move this along, but I told Senator Coghill in a conversation earlier today that I didn't think the bill was going to leave the committee today, that I want to make sure that what we send out has been sort of through a couple times. We worked on it Friday. We're working on it today. We'll probably work on it again Wednesday. So my suggestion is we'll have a vote on this amendment and then hold the bill over to Wednesday to see if they're, depending on the vote on the amendment, a few more little massages before we send it up to the Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
There is one other thing that Mr. Ball had brought up that that would fall into the same section, and that is the three of the largest contributors should be contributors of the largest amounts. And I think that that was probably cleaner and more worthwhile language. And so because of the way I structured this amendment, and it's not going to fall into this bill the way it's been constructed, and since you took the amendment of Section E out already, I can see that that my argument for the three largest or the five largest is going to probably not prevail, and this amendment doesn't scoot it. I'll withdraw the amendment, but I think we should clean up the three largest contributors or the five largest, whichever this committee chose to do. I would like to take another stab at it. Because of the amount of requirements, the amount of disclosure requirements already put upon them, I think that three is okay, but I understand your sentiment. So based on that, I'm willing to withdraw this amendment and kind of take another run at what should be both the candidate and the person or the corporation requirement. I'm afraid, though, Mr. Chairman, that if we don't have some similarity between them, we might fall into a legal entanglement that says we're treating people unequally. And whether candidates or those who have other political say, we have distinguished between groups and non-groups and candidates. Now we have the person who is kind of the corporation. If we put more on them and don't have that same requirement on the candidate, I think we could run afoul, cause some problems, put it that way. So that's what my intention bringing the amendment forward was on.
Just so we're procedurally squared away, you are withdrawing amendment.
I'll go ahead and withdraw the amendment, knowing that we have other issues that we really do need to come at.
And I think I agree with you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, yeah, I appreciate Senator Coghill's clarifying what he had intended with lines 17 through 21, the candidate saying approval. And I guess I'd be curious to hear legal's opinion on that, whether or not they feel there's some sort of an equal protection argument that could be made for having different requirements for candidates versus corporations.
Mr. Bowler, did you hear the question?
Senator French, members of the committee, yes, I did hear the question. Off the cuff, I don't have a ready legal response.
Well, we'll give you till Wednesday. How about that?
That's entirely agreeable, Senator French.
Thank you. Amendment number three has been withdrawn. We do have a couple more. It does raise a couple of more, I guess I'll call them tweaks at this point to the bill before it leaves the committee. Is there further committee discussion of 284 concerns, issues, while we've got it here? Keeping in mind that we will bring it back Wednesday, but I'm really going to try to get it out of committee that day. I just think it's time for it to go on. Senator Wilkowski.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I guess I'd be curious if Mr. Bullard has any comment on whether or not we could restrict corporations from or unions from participating in activities where they had foreign shareholders.
Mr. Bullard.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. Federal law already prohibits foreign nationals from involving themselves in our federal, state, and local elections. In some cases, this extends to American corporations or American subsidies of foreign corporations, where foreign nationals are directing the decisions in terms of how they involve themselves in our electoral processes. There are possible federal preemption arguments if the state were to involve itself in attempting to regulate or govern American corporations with foreign ownership or some portion of foreign ownership in the same field. There is no immediate and clear answer to your question.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concern that I would have is if you had a foreign government, foreign corporation that wanted to come to Alaska and set up an Alaskan corporation that is essentially owned by foreigners and attempt to influence the elections here in Alaska. And that's a concern that I have. That's a concern that I've heard from constituents back home, that we have this potential gap now where American corporations heavily influenced or owned in large part by foreign corporations could influence our elections. And are you saying there's nothing we can do about that?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair. I think that the situation that you describe is already prohibited by federal law. An American subsidy of a foreign corporation has to use proceeds from their American operation to fund any sort of electioneering communication or any sort of involvement in an American election. If direction for how to proceed is coming from overseas, or if they're being reimbursed by the foreign parent corporation, their involvement would be prohibited. This has been the state of law for a little while. Since previously we prohibited corporations absolutely, it's a novel issue in Alaska, and it's a new scenario, whether we need to do this as a state. And I don't know whether we can or not. I'm just alerting the committee to the possible preemption argument.
I've got a question while Senator Willikowski is thinking. What about restricting corporate involvement in Alaska elections only to those U.S. corporations domiciled in Alaska, those that have, you know, that are incorporated under our laws and not, say, the laws of Delaware or Texas or even Washington State?
Senator French, I can imagine a number of constitutional arguments against such a position. Again, off the cuff, I'm not entirely comfortable breaking down what they might look like, but I can certainly provide an opinion on the topic.
I think that would be useful. And I guess if we've got a couple of days, if you can maybe sketch out some of the concerns that Senator Willikowski has raised, I know I share them, and so he raises good points about, you know, the possibility of, you know, the further away you get Alaska, I think the more suspicion that Alaskans have about who's influencing their elections. This is novel, and I think you have a right to be concerned about a shell corporation operating with strings attached to who knows where, trying to manipulate voters. And so if we've got federal laws on the books that are taking care of that, that's great. If we need our own state statutes to deal with it, now's the time.
Well, and I guess I would even take that a step further, Mr. Chair. To the extent that we could prohibit corporations that had foreign shareholders that had X percentage of stock or X dollars of stock, I think because we don't allow foreign nationals to participate in elections, there's been a policy that's been the policy of the United States government for years, and now we have this Supreme Court case that sort of opens the door to backdoor allowing foreign nationals to participate in elections and influence them. So I would be very interested in trying to pursue methods that we can prevent that sort of thing, Mr. Chair.
And keeping in mind that the days are ticking towards adjournment, I totally share your sentiment. I totally want to do what we can, but I also want to make sure we don't miss the opportunity to pass a bill that gets a large chunk of the problem solved. But it's a stimulating conversation. Mr. Bullard, I think we've given you a little bit of direction. Any other comment from, we've got Holly Hill on the line. Anything we've said today that provokes some comment from you, Ms. Hill?
Holly Hill, Executive Director of the APOC. I just got in this meeting. I was in House Finance until now.
And Jason Brandeis from APOC?
I have no comments at this time.
And Mr. Patasson from the Department of Law.
Same, but I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
All right, very good. Thank you. I think the committee's, we've worked on the amendments we have in front of us. We've got a couple more days to continue working. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll adjourn a little bit early.